The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives.
I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. In late February of 2017, the Washington Post debuted its new mission statement, Democracy Dies in Darkness. At the time, then-President Donald Trump had made no secret of his disdain for the press, regularly brandishing attacks against the media in person and on Twitter. The famed journalist Bob Woodward said at the time, quote, "The press is not the enemy, and the concern in the press is that we'll have a secret government. That government does things that we should know about that we don't," end quote. He also added, "Democracies die in darkness, so we're working against the darkness." How the times have changed. Exactly 8 years later, the Post unveiled its new mission statement, pivoting from its iconic Democracy Dies in Darkness slogan to, quote, "riveting storytelling for all of America." This shift, amid staff rebellion and declining revenues, reflects a broader tension in modern journalism. The pull between rigorous watchdog reporting and the pressure to engage audiences across platforms. Yet this evolution comes at a critical moment when data-driven journalism has never been more essential to uncovering the truth. The journey to this crossroads began decades ago. In 1952, CBS used a UNIVAC mainframe to predict Eisenhower's landslide victory, marking one of the first applications of computer analysis in journalism. By the 1960s, pioneering journalists like Philip Beyer were applying social science methods to investigative reporting, using data analytics to debunk popular theories about the Detroit riots. This marriage of computational power and journalistic inquiry laid the foundation for what we now call data journalism. As technology evolved, so did the practice. The rise of personal computers in the 1980s democratized data analysis, while the internet revolution of the 1990s and 2000s transformed how journalists could access, analyze, and present information. The emergence of open data movements and digital tools has expanded these possibilities exponentially, enabling journalists to process vast amounts of information and present it in ways that make complex theories accessible to broad audiences. Today's data journalists leverage sophisticated tools for scraping, cleaning, analyzing, and visualizing data that would have seemed like science fiction to their predecessors. Interactive news applications and data visualizations have become standard features of major news outlets, while algorithmic approaches to reporting help surface patterns and hidden stories in vast datasets. This evolution has transformed how we investigate everything from political corruption to climate change. However, these developments in data journalism arrive at a critical moment of tension between traditional media and social media platforms. As major tech companies scale back fact-checking programs and content moderation efforts, the role of data-driven journalism in maintaining public trust becomes even more vital. Yet this comes precisely when social media platforms are making it harder to distinguish verified information from misinformation, and when access to quality data is increasingly restricted or manipulated. The challenges facing data journalism extend far beyond technical hurdles or resource constraints. They are fundamental questions about accuracy, transparency, and ethics that must be addressed. How do we ensure data analysis is rigorous when the pressure for rapid content production is relentless? What standards should govern the use of AI and algorithms in journalistic work? And perhaps, most crucially, how do we maintain journalistic integrity in an environment when tech platforms, the primary distributors of news, seem to be retreating from their commitment to factual information?
Our guest today is Alexander B. Howard. Alexander is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and digital governance expert who has significantly shaped open government initiatives and technology policy. As a democracy advocate at Demand Progress and the deputy director at the Sunlight Foundation, he has been instrumental in advancing government transparency in civic technology. He served on the U.S. Freedom of Information Advisory Committee from 2022 to 2024 and Canada's Open Government Advisory Panel from 2012 to 2015, contributing to key policy reforms. Alexander's work spans journalism, advocacy, and policy analysis, with contributions to major publications including the New York Times, Wired, and MIT's Tech Review. Recognized twice as one of Washington's tech titans by the Washingtonian, Alexander has been particularly influential in promoting digital democracy and government accountability, including helping draft the Honest Ads Act and advocating for the successful passage of the Freedom of Information Improvement Act and Open Government Data Act. He holds a BA in biology and sociology from Colby College and has been a trusted voice on digital governance across academic, governmental, and media platforms. Today, he is writing at Civic Texts, the publication focused on emerging technologies, digital democracy, and public policy he launched last year. Welcome, Alexander.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, looking at the evolution of data journalism from the early days of computer-assisted reporting to today's advanced tools, as Alexa mentioned, what would you say have been the most transformative developments in how journalists use data to tell stories?
I usually start this particular story considerably earlier. I know that it's tempting to focus on data and the zeros and ones, the bits and bytes, the digital transformation that is shifting how and where we discover information, what it can tell about us or the world. But I usually go back centuries further, because there was a demand for accurate information about the world from people who were consuming the earliest newspapers, the merchants in Italy, and then business people around the world. And the decisions that they were making in commerce had to be driven by actionable information. And if you think about one of the most important forms of data journalism, it's not necessarily one you necessarily think of in this way, but Bloomberg terminals, which people subscribe to for tens of thousands of dollars, are data driven. They're giving people actionable insights to make decisions in a business context, which assets to buy or sell and when. And they have that information as fast as they can get it, which enables them to be ahead of people outside of that Bloomberg space. And the practice of collecting data statistics, of course, is something that predates the world of computers. And I think that that's a really important thing to remember, that a lot of the phenomena that you've described exist in a profoundly analog world. And a lot of the concerns that exist today are the same ones that the Victorians offered great fear of and when the telegraph showed up, right? So the waves of change that have accelerated into the 20th and now 21st century, I think are bringing us to a really interesting inflection point now, because the power asynchronies, right? The idea that knowledge is power, the power asynchronies are now shifting to the people who have access to the best, most actionable data and the compute power to do something with it. And that's where I think we're going to see some of the greatest breakthroughs this year and some of the greatest disruptions. Because you mentioned what happens when people's computers connected to the internet, well, shifting when people get computers. I think that there's reasons to believe that having access to artificial intelligence, the generative kind, right, this more relatively novel phenomenon, not necessarily the machine learning I was writing about a decade ago, that capacity is going to be disruptive potentially to nation states, which is why we see great power conflict around it. And why we saw news yesterday about the United States investing at a like a moonshot level, to start with, in trying to compete on that count. What's I think going to be interesting is the extent to which that is something that enables people to find more actionable information, right? The point of getting access, right? Or it leads to the creation of more great goo, right? This concern a long time ago that there'd be nanocomputers that would kind of all die and create a gray goo of everything. I don't know if that's where we are. I think it's more likely that we're going to see an acceleration of rivers of false information, of AI slop, so to speak.
Right. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it? Is that right now we're at a point where both we have the compute power to analyze things in great detail and drill down on facts and new developments in the scientific and objective front, at the same time as we have the ability to create ever more believable falsities, and all of this against the backdrop of omission of facts is as much a storytelling as sharing of reality. So it seems like the fundamental tension may not be new, but it's really being accelerated by all of this compute power. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's right. The idea of algorithmic illusions is interesting. The point you make about omission is very important. We live in a world where anybody, I'm holding up a smartphone here, right, can record, bear witness to something, upload that video. That raw reporting, which is what it is, can be journalistic. There was the person who filmed the murder of George Floyd got a Pulitzer Prize because they wanted to recognize that capturing that video was a form of bearing witness. Now, we knew where and when she did that, and then the context was added afterwards, right, in terms of everyone's reporting. And those two things, the verification and the context, are what makes it journalism. And omitting context is what makes something less journalistic. And the people who are interested in spreading misleading information for power, for profit, for political gain, for fun, right, will deliberately distort information. And make and the tools that we are seeing now, I think, are easily configured to do that. It's, make me a graph of this. Make me a table of that, make me a figure of this, right? And they'll take what's there and maybe what's not. We've seen lots of examples where these different machines, the algorithmic engines, right, are citing papers that don't exist, review articles that don't exist. And if that then gets pulled in to making visualizations, which typically are more compelling to humans, we love maps, right? We love figures that show something. Confirmation bias then leads us to want to believe it and to share it to show our beliefs. Right? The new lawn sign, is what we're showing on social media. Then we have a huge challenge, and we're living in the consequences of that right now. As I speak here in Washington, D.C., there are people who have affirmatively, objectively false beliefs about different phenomena in the world. We could go down and list them, but the most important thing is to recognize that there are bespoke alternative realities, not just facts, but participatory mass delusion about what's happening in the world. And that scale of false belief, I'm not inclined to believe that it's altogether new. In fact, I think that throughout history, there are actually substantial portions of society who believe things that weren't true. The one that might be unfortunately relevant today is 1930s Germany, where a large number of people were kind of all in on the idea that Germany didn't lose the war, World War I, that is. And that belief in it and their anger at who did that changed the world in some fairly dramatically negative ways. The concept of something that's so large that it can't possibly be an untruth is something we are now living with in a heavy way. And it's unfortunately a real challenge for anyone who grew up in a world of empiricism, of facts, to figure out how to engage with that productively, which accurately describes me. As you mentioned, I was trained as a biologist, a sociologist, coming up as a journalist, technology policy journalist, advocate. Facts are sacred to me. Scientific theories that are made up of facts are canonical to me, right? And now we see the phenomena of people wholesale rejecting what's literally in front of their eyes, not just what's in books, but like what they see, because they're being told it's not real or didn't really happen. And it's very difficult to bring a textbook to a meme fight. And it's something that we're all going to have to grapple with over time.
I think it's the pull of, and let me quote this riveting storytelling, which is what, which for me means what attracts eyeballs and what attracts attention. And we are an attention economy, and what attracts advertising dollars. I want to ask you, when you see, when you heard about the Washington Post and their new slogan, riveting storytelling for all of America, what do you think when you read this new mission statement? And how do you think seeing this affects the practice and priorities of data journalism?
I had a strongly negative reaction. You know, to be honest, it's on the internet for people who want to see it. I think that I think Democracy Dies in Darkness is still on the paper. I think
yes, it is.
The motto is still there, but this mission statement is animating. I think it's supposed to be a prompt to the newsroom, but it seems like the sort of thing you write in a memo. In a world where we have these challenges and attention, I want you all to focus on riveting storytelling. And I want to think you to think about how to present it in such a way that all Americans can benefit from it, will be engaged by it, will see themselves in it, will be open to it. It fundamentally runs into a challenge in reality, though, which is that tens of millions of Americans have tapped out of the Washington Post as a thing, right? It's not just about their drop in subscriber numbers because of Bezos blocking the endorsement. It's about tens of millions of people being told by their elected leader, unfortunately an authoritarian personality cult, that what they're writing isn't real, that they make up sources, that they're lying to you, that they hate people like you, and you shouldn't believe them. And it's part of a deliberate strategy, authoritarian playbook, for listeners who want to go and dig into the common tactic and strategies that autocrats have around the world for delegitimizing adversarial journalism that holds them to account for fraud, waste, abuse of power, right?
Corruption.
Criminality. And the first thing that authoritarian movements attack is shared collective fact, because they need to control the narrative. So they look, quickly move to control state propaganda and then seek to repress a free press, right? And there's lots of different ways that that happens. My concern with the Post is that they've created the appearance that their work is being affected by the owner, because it has been, in terms of the damage done to their reputation, to their integrity, to the perceived ability to speak truth to power, because he stopped them from doing that. LA Times had the same experience. It does appear that the LA Times owner has a much more direct, onerous involvement in editorial than Bezos has at the Post. No one I've spoke to there said he's interfered with them. The person who has interfered with them is the CEO, who's lost the newsroom, and we're now seeing talent bleed. People who have extraordinary talent are shifting to other news outlets, leaving to do their own things. Like that, the ones who have agency, who have the ability to do that, are doing it. My preference would have been a simpler motto: facts first. I think that what there's still a hunger for in the country are facts. Who, what, where, when, how. And if you can figure it out, why? That's hard news. The challenge is when those facts don't line up with what people in power want to be true. Say the introduction of a novel airborne virus that can lead to terrible outcomes, up to and including death, which is what happened in 2020. We're headed into a really scary period in our country. We've been through a pandemic before, but it won't be the last one. The increasing encroachment of humans into lots of different new biological pools around the world means that we'll see more zoonotic diseases emerge. Right now, we're watching, praying, on my count, not to see avian flu start to move human to human and have a new pandemic. And that's in this important context because we just saw an order come down that says that Health and Human Services, the CDC, is not supposed to put out public communications. That is blinding the public to what our government knows. That's authoritarian blindness. And in the context of that, we need our papers. We need our media outlets. We need everybody who has an objective source of facts. Humans aren't objective, but the facts may be, right? To defend that, to make sure that the public has lamps of knowledge to light them through the way.
So at the same time as there are strong business interests to make, compelling narratives to try to prop up. I mean, for years we've been talking about how the internet is undermining the whole news media industry as a business, right? Because people would rather read stuff online or get everything, all content for free, and why do I have to pay you anyway? So there's that whole dynamic going on. And so at a time when, for business reasons, as you say, if it was an instruction to the newsroom to say, be more compelling to people, maybe that makes sense from a business perspective. Is part of the challenge that some of our struggling news outlets, like the Washington Post, are looking at the social media platforms and seeing them as being successful for the promoting of stories, irrespective of veracity. And trying to tap into some of that from a financial perspective. I'm asking that as a question to see if that's in part why this is happening, not because I think it's a good outcome in any way.
So there's three different things in that I'd unpack. The first is that the newspapers enjoyed advertising monopolies in their local markets for a long time. And then a bunch of different internet businesses came along and peeled off parts of that bundle, classifieds, singles, right? The advertising bundle that meant that some papers that had 20% profit margins in the 90s no longer did. And that kind of advertising subsidized a lot of the accountability journalism that they produced. And the vast majority of accountability journalism at the local level came out of newspapers. That's just how it is. Local news, in terms of what's on the radio or TV outlets, people want their weather, their traffic, their crime, their local interests. Maybe there'll be investigations of what's happening if you have producers who care about that and have resources. They're likely to keep standing. But the first thing, it's not just the internet as a whole. It's that the business models of the papers and the other outlets has been undermined at the same time that there has not been a societal wide investment in sustaining public media to produce civic information. One of the failures of this last administration is, we heard from the president in his farewell address, President Biden, talking about the rise of misinformation, talking about the risks of these things, and yet he didn't do anything to make a difference in terms of investing in news media ecosystems that would provide trustworthy information in the growing news deserts around our country. So that's the first thing. Second, what you're talking about with attention is very important in terms of the internet. Companies like Netflix know that people are second screening them or even third screening them now. And so they're doing things like having the characters narrate what they're doing because they know someone's listening. when you're creating a news product, you're not just competing with other outlets. You're competing with shopping, sports, gambling, computer, games, right, of all kinds. You're competing for someone's time and attention against other content that is likely to be more engaging than hard news, unless the hard news is about a fast-moving, kinetic story that has like societal wide interest, in which case there's a feeding frenzy like wildfires, right? Or a conflict. But over time, because the fatigue that people have has meant that there's a lot of people tuning out, right? Not tuning in, dropping off, not subscribing, not paying attention because they're so overwhelmed by design by different entities who want to overwhelm, who want to flood the zone with exhausting amounts of information, with a river, as Mr. Bannon, Steve Bannon once said, can I curse in your podcast? Right? Like of I think we might say of cow feces, right? Or bull feces. How about that? We'll be elegant. And that's by design. And then the third part of that, right? So you've got the undermining of the business models. You've got vast amounts of other things people can spend time doing that are entertaining to them. Third part is that the sources have gone direct. And I'm cribbing from NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen on this, who's been a mentor to me in many ways, in the sense that media have been disintermediated by all of the different powerful forces in society who no longer have to go through the radio stations, newspapers, and TV stations to reach people. And most significantly, that's true of politicians and governments. State propaganda is not new. Campaign propaganda is not new, right? But it is new to have planetary scale platforms where people's sense of what's true and what's not are mediated by the people they trust, who tell them if it is or not, and then they toe the line. And sometimes you see the party leader flip around and say, well, now this is accurate.
Don't you think there's also a tension in terms of what makes for riveting storytelling versus what's actually very impactful in terms of people's lives? I'll give you an example. The controversy around the release of forever chemicals, PFAS, into water systems by companies like DuPont. That was a very long investigative journalism effort that brought to light the potential toxicity to mass populations and how long these companies had been doing it and getting away with it. Now, that doesn't necessarily make for, a riveting news story that is relatable to everybody. Not everybody knows what forever chemicals are, and you'd have to have context and how they get into our water systems. However, what somebody wore at the inauguration, maybe that becomes a much more so the headlines become those that are more, let's say, cotton candy-esque. They are momentarily they give you some entertainment value, but they don't enrich your lives in terms of actual information that you need to have. So is there, do you feel that that conflict is also there, this disparity between really important news stories that are not necessarily as sexy or as riveting as more fluff that can gather the attention of people much faster?
I think that it exists in the sense that we're all white hairless apes and we like to look at each other. We like to see what the other people are wearing, what they're doing. We have, in our culture, glorified celebrity. It is the goal of many young people to be a celebrity, whether an athlete or an influencer on the internet, right? And to achieve material success, and then to show that material success in different ways. And there's lots of ways that people signal success, and they're very contextual, right? if you're going to communities in some parts of the country, looking like someone who just got a lot of money and buying fancy cars or expensive things is not necessarily an entry point, right? If you look at how wealthy people behave, they have different ways of showing that. Other people who have power might show that differently. What you're asking about, I think, though, is this question of how to make a news story like that compelling to people. And that's the art part of this. That's the craft part of this. That is where, in an ideal world, you see storytelling techniques that are leveraged to put people at the center of the story. So, yes, this is a story about powerful corporations profiting from selling chemicals and then trying to conceal them, right? The concealing is where you get some tension in there, but where you make it more interesting is the impact upon people. Now, you can choose different techniques to explain this, but when I was mentored as a journalist, I was always told, find a way to get people into the story that puts them in it so they can imagine why this matters. Now, we have a huge challenge in the sense I think we have disaster fatigue. The human mind, body, and spirit were not designed to be connected all of the time to the world's pain. There have been two different conflicts this last couple of years that are full of pain that we're aware of, right? What's happening in Ukraine, what's been happening in Gaza. But there are other wars around the world too that are full of extraordinarily awful things happening to people. And the only way we protect ourselves from that is by backing off it a little bit, because if you really look, you could spend all day traumatizing yourself.
I think we really are already pretty traumatized. I think that the sense of doom that that people feel, at least in the Western world, is and amongst young adults, is palpable largely
Let me
because of
just say, though,
that.
that it can be worse.
Great.
But taking your point though, isn't it then doesn't it make Washington Post's new mission statement in a way okay? What they're saying is, look, I mean, you can take it this way. We're going to take the regular journalistic stories and we're just going to do a better job of storytelling. Is that how you take it?
I have no problem with the Washington Post trying to do the best riveting storytelling it can. I'm all for it. But I would like them to be focusing on facts first, because storytelling symbolizes something to a lot of people that isn't journalism. Basic unit of journalism is typically, I'm going to write a story. But people hear story, and then if they're not in the newsroom, they may be thinking, well, you're going to tell me a
Fiction.
story? Is that what kind of story are you telling me? And for people who are already deeply distrustful, that doesn't signal journalism. It signals you telling me a story about what you want me to believe with your facts and your figures. And I know what I believe, and I have my facts and my figures, and it creates distance. What I want is for journalistic organizations and journalists and scientists and anyone else who is dedicated to building edifices of information online that are trustworthy and can be trusted, to focus on facts first, to state the facts first, and then to state what we know, how we know it, in an open way, right? To show their work. That's an ethos of data journalism, to bring it back to this. To do whatever they can to create trust along every part of the process. And I've seen people's reaction to this. It's not just about me, right? It's the mass reaction to this post motto, post mission statement, I should say. And it's not entirely positive, right? It seems to be taken in the sense that you're going to tell me stories that are engaging. But, so do other tabloid outlets. What is the front of the National Enquirer if not engaging? Tabloids are designed to be engaging. They are the very outlets that focus upon what people are wearing, or who said what to what, or what's, who slighted who. They're not focused upon the sort of the deeper currents of history and helping people understand where they fit in and how and where history changes because of people's actions, which is one of the most important things that we can focus on as a society right now, because there's a great deal of nihilism, there's a great deal of grief, there's a great deal of anger, there's some degree of hopelessness right now. And if we don't remind people of past generations and what they went through during the civil rights movement, during the suffrage movement, during the Civil War and Reconstruction, then we risk losing touch of how we got to this point. We did not start in the United States as a nation where everyone had the vote. Only more or less white men with property or other assets had the vote, about 6% of the country. And it's only over time, through decades and decades of activism, that we got to the point where women, where men, where anyone else had the opportunity to vote.
Is part of the problem here the fact that we're talking about a change in approach, a change, a step away from maybe data journalism and transparency in what is effectively a monopoly? I mean, it's not unique. The Washington Post is not unique. But on the one hand, there's an opportunity here for journalists who truly espouse the principles that you're articulating to step up and start something, right? I think you've done exactly that. The problem is that just like everybody abandoning Twitter, it's very hard to find a single other place for everybody to start following, support, and build up attention. So is there an analogous challenge here that there may be opportunities for remembering these truths, but the problem is they won't have the same kind of impact because it won't be a bunch of smaller efforts?
So a couple things there. I think that part of the challenge here is about more compelling storytelling online and understanding that we live in a moment where there's a lot more visual journalism, a lot more people dealing with video. I'm a very text-based person. I'm weird. I read books, I read long-form magazines, I write a lot. And that's still my primary output, although I've been taking lots of pictures. I have not necessarily adjusted to that world. I am not on TikTok for various reasons. But that doesn't mean that I don't need to get with it and get better at using different tools to connect with people. I don't think that the values that I articulated are in tension with that world. I think that they need to be adapted to the formats and platforms that exist. I do think that the values may be in conflict with the evolution of different social platforms. You said everyone's leaving Twitter. I don't think that's true. I think that there's quite a lot of people who are still there around the world.
Yeah, that's fair. But of those leaving Twitter, there is a sense of where am I going to find you again? I mean,
That's true.
I've had friends on social media say, "Please tell me where you're going if you're leaving this platform because I want to stay in touch."
And this is something that I've been writing about and following for a long time, almost 2 decades. And the answer for me continues to be the World Wide Web. The place that people should find you is on the web, because all of these different social platforms are someone else's app, service, or website. They have their own terms of service. They have a sysadmin and rules that mean that you can be kicked off at any time. And I have been suspended from all of them at one time or another over the years. And that's taught me to approach things deliberatively in terms of thinking about where and when I put things that could have an impact upon that, but also to be prepared to lose access to them if either I get flagged by something or an owner decides they don't like what I'm saying. I could be booted off of any of them tomorrow. Now, I don't think the risk of that is the same across platforms. I think that the evolution of Twitter into X under Musk, there's a huge sense of normlessness and of ambiguity in the sense that what you do or say there could lead to him deciding that you're off, you're demonetized, you're deplatformed, you're suspended if he decides that the rules have changed or he just doesn't like you. And the response to that is to make sure that you are distributed across other platforms, but also that you think about kind of basic marketing. Like, do you have the same namespace across them? Do you have a website there? Have you made it possible for people to find you through search engines for good search engine optimization? This stuff I was writing about back in 2006 and 7 for journalists getting online, right? So I was working at an IT media company that had seen around the bend in the 90s for how buying and of anything related to information technology was going to be shifting online. So they got out early to the concept of precisely targeted marketing on search engines that then brought people searching for information into their platforms and led them through the buying process.
But if the Washington Post dies in narratives, where does that leave people looking for actual news? I mean, if all of the other journalistic sources follow your fine advice, and I subscribe to it 100%, does that create a news environment that can replace what the Washington Post does today?
I don't think that the Washington Post is going to die in narratives. I don't think that's how it's going to go. I think that it's more likely that we're going to see Bezos sell it to someone, or that we're going to see its journalism be muted and be less effective because of the talent drain. But I don't think we're going to see that this shift means that it dies. I think it might become a different entity, but I don't see evidence that that's happened yet. I just see evidence of talent drain, and I see evidence that their editorial page has been affected by the owner. That's what I see so far. I do not think it's a bad thing for people who are focused on telling a story to do it better. Full stop. I think everyone who's interested in engaging the public must do that better. You cannot just sit back and expect the facts to speak for themselves, although there's a lot of that in still in the journalistic world, right? The challenge is that if we're living in a world where people discovering information are doing it in these other places, are you there or not? Are you there to shape that collective understanding as it's happening, or are you coming in after the fact to say, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, when the social facts have already been created? This is an incredibly difficult thing for journalists to do. I think that at people's best, they act almost like community managers who are able to like reach out and say, what do we confirm? What haven't we confirmed? How do we know it or not? And that function is very different from being like the arbiter of what is true. It's important to establish facts and to say that, put that down in the actual story. But it's to report with the community in a way that builds trust. I think that the question you're asking is deeply complicated because of the shifts in distribution and discovery that social media and search engines have brought us to, and that AI is now kind of surging even further. And my sense is that we're going to see many, many different approaches around the world, and we'll see which ones work and which don't. I still think that there's enough hunger for hard news about some things, that there'll be outlets that endure that produce it. Much more tenuous are the places that do that don't have effective subsidy through advertising anymore. And no one has a good answer for that yet.
Let me bring up the issue of the journalist safety, because for us to get information, let's say from conflict zones, we are relying on right now on two sources: firsthand accounts, people taping something, videotaping something, uploading it, sometimes without context, but also where They're killed. So last year, for example, 68 journalists were killed, according to UNESCO. And 18 of them, this was the in 2024, it was the most journalists killed in conflict zones. So does that then, the threat to journalists is not to journalism, but also to the journalist's safety, does that then put additional stress on the whole idea of data journalism and reporting? In other words, does that make journalists now want to rely on other sources, like other tools, such as AI, for example? And how do you see that progressing?
So I guess I'd say two things. The first is that it's important that we don't act like data journalism is something else, right? In an ideal world, it's just journalism, right? It's just people when they look at a given phenomenon, a given story, the first thing they do is say, well, what do we know about this, right? What does the evidence show us? What data is available about this? Or not. And for stories where the data doesn't exist, how could we collect it? And for stories where it does, how trustworthy is the data? What have we done before? Something like crime rate, right? But there are huge fights in our country about this. But it's quite important for establishing the truth of different narratives or not, right? There are people who claim that immigrants are associated with crime. The data show that people who are immigrants commit fewer crimes than people who are born in a country. Now, that obviously runs straight into a very old and ugly narrative about immigrants bringing crime and disease into a country, which then justifies different policy actions. That runs, crime rates, that runs straight into how do we approach community policing? How do we approach dealing with people who are having health issues, mental health issues, and creating alternative models for policing? Right. These are things that I think are not in opposition. And the more we get away from data journalism as its own practice, as opposed to something that everyone has to have as part of their tool set, I think we're better off. The senior executive service in the federal government just amended its sort of qualifications for people. And now it's included data science, data literacy specifically. I do not think you can be a reporter coming up and not be data literate. A lot of people say, well, you got to be good at social media. Well, fine, that's one set of tools. There are others, right? If you look at baseball players come up, we talk about five tool players. Can you run? Can you hit? Can you field? Right? Can you hit for power? Like these are all things that you want to see. And my experience is that the less we talk about this is that other, the more we bring them together, the better. War reporting is the most dangerous thing typically that any correspondent will do. Journalists have been getting killed in wars as long as we've had them. I think the statistics are actually worse than you cited. I think they're most journalists since the people have been tracking have died, particularly in the conflict in Gaza. And that's actually a really important microcosm of where we are in the sense that there you have a military that has targeted journalists and lied about it, unfortunately. Like that's just how it is. And they've done it to blind people to what's happening, the world and their own people. And that is unfortunately something our government failed to decry and sanction them for, because killing journalists intentionally, murdering them, is a war crime. And that's unfortunately a phenomenon we should expect to continue anywhere there is a war. Our country's standing to decry human rights abuses and war crimes has now been diminished by our silence there. We were, I thought, effective decrying what Russia was doing. And Russia, of course, is quite famous for killing journalists. Putin is not a fan. But then that's true everywhere. There's an authoritarian nation, right? Any place where a state has moved away from liberal democratic principles into something else, journalists are inimical to that process because they're an independent source of facts about what's happening in society and can tell people about what and where and how is happening to people in their country or in other countries because of the actions of their own elected leaders.
Well, and I feel like it's this is a story, a narrative that is sort of at a peak point, at an inflection point, as you said earlier. And I feel like we're going to have to come back to it because it's clearly going to be in full evolution this year and for a while to come. So for now, though, I'll say thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing how this works out.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that you offered some space to talk. I enjoyed the conversation, and as I would say, just in parting, stay safe out there. I think that we're all going to be thinking about how we protect ourselves. Journalists, I think, have always needed to do that, but now we need to be looking at how to use different tools for encryption, for searching, for thinking about protecting yourself in different contexts. And those are all out there. For people who don't know, the Electronic Frontier Foundation offers great thinking on this. And for people who are tech focused, they may have heard about the telecom hack of last year. If you're not using encrypted email and messaging, it's time to start.
Great parting words. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me. Take care.
Great, thanks.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.